Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting by talking with you about ageism. It's a problem many people face. And today we'll talk about how you can reduce ageism in your life. And we have a couple of guests for you today. Two advocates for senior citizens. Ann Elbert, with me in the studio, Executive Director of Age Better Incorporated, based in Madison. Ann Elbert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry.
It's great to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. With us by phone, Dr. Regina Kapp, a clinical geropsychologist and the founder and director of the Center for Mental Health and Aging, based in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Kapp, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and addressing this topic.
Well, it's an important topic. And as you listen into the show, listeners, you can join the conversation. Have you been maybe subjected to ageism? If so, how'd you deal with it? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk@WPR.org. You know, Dr. Kapp, it might be worth it to start with a definition of ageism.
Yes, I agree. It is so helpful to know what we're talking about. So ageism are stereotypes, which is how we think, prejudice, which is how we feel, and discrimination, which is how we act toward ourselves or others based on their age or the age we perceive them to be. And it disproportionately affects older people.
Yeah. And is it usually obvious when it occurs?
Not always. Sometimes it can be really subtle. And it can show up in a lot of different ways. It can show up when you... something as simple as going to a restaurant or attending a group activity, something like that. It can show up in very different ways. I've had friends tell me that when they go and attend a group activity, sometimes they feel that as they get older that they're invisible. That's is something a little more subtle, but maybe questions aren't asked of them or they're not being engaged. Other people are not engaging.
And Dr. Kapp, certainly ageism has consequences. How does ageism limit, let's say, the contributions of older people in the workplace? And in science, in society generally.
Yeah, well, ageism has far-reaching consequences. The more negative stereotypes we have about growing older, the more likely we are to have physical health problems like cardiovascular disease, dementia disorders, mental health problems like depression, anxiety. And the more positive beliefs we have about aging, the more likely we are to live a longer and healthier life. There was one study that showed that people who have a positive belief about aging are more likely to live 7.5 years longer than adults who have negative views of aging. And so, like Anne was talking about, ageism can play out in terms of who's invited into conversations, who's invited to social gatherings, even into what we believe about what's possible as we age. So a common stereotype is that older adults are set in their ways and are impervious to change. Why would they change after all this time? And actually, that's not true. But if we believe that is true, then we won't be inviting older adults into conversations. And we won't be, if we see, for myself as a psychologist, if we see mental health problems arise in older adulthood and we believe that older adults won't change, we're less likely to encourage them to seek mental health or physical health care for really important concerns that can be treated. And so it has severe consequences all throughout older adulthood, but it's far-reaching from physical health to mental health to social life.
Yeah. Do you think... I wonder what the problem is. You know, if somebody, why would somebody just not involve somebody else in a conversation because they're older? Or why would the might be the last person to be served approached for a menu or something like that for a dinner? Why? What is it in our minds that creates this kind of problem? You know,
I think that what I see are opportunities we have to break down barriers that sometimes occur as we grow older. So there may be issues, or maybe a person has a maybe low hearing or mobility challenges. So when we create events or environments where we are not accommodating to those, sometimes that will automatically prevent someone from engaging or participating. And I think sometimes, too, there's the tendency to experience something maybe with one or two people and then to generalize. And so we need to be really mindful about, really seeking the opportunities and acknowledging all the strengths that we see and that we experience if we take the time.
Yeah. Dr. Kep, you founded and serve as director for the Center for Mental Health and Aging. It's described on your website as a professional and public education company. How'd you get this started, and what do you do?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for asking. So as a geropsychologist working in large medical systems, so from the Atlanta VA healthcare system, Emory, Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, I trained at Stanford, I saw repeatedly firsthand that the mental health needs of older adults were often overlooked, untreated. There was a lot of misinformation about what's typical for older adults and not typical as it relates to mental health concerns. So, for example, there's a misconception that depression is normal as we age, and it is not. Depression risk actually decreases with age, because resilience increases, psychological resilience increases as we age. And so what happens, though, is if we think that depression, anxiety, dementia is normal with aging, then we're not going to be identifying it and treating it. And when we don't treat mental health concerns, this also has very severe consequences, like worsening of medical problems, more medications for medical problems, more ER visits, higher risk for dementia disorders, higher risk for suicide, and more family strain and caregiving strain. And when we treat mental health concerns in older adulthood, it actually protects us from these things. And so my sort of personal call to action and mission has been to spread the word about this so that we can identify mental health concerns and get people the care and treatment that they need. And one of the reasons this is so important, too, is that I want to live in a society where we continue to believe that at any age, healing and transformation and growth are possible. I don't want to live in a society where at a certain age we stop growing and transforming and evolving. And that's what ageism wants us to believe, and it's a lie. And it affects every aspect of a person's life. And so this is why, Larry, it's so important that you're addressing the topic today, and that Anne is hosting an event that is, she'll talk about, that is bringing this topic to light, because it affects all of us. And we can all do something about it.
And you have, and thanks for that comment, Dr. Kep. And Anne, you have a free event in Madison next week that focuses on this issue.
Yes, we do. We're super excited. So SAIL is Sharing Active Independent Lives. And we're a nonprofit network of members, people over the age of 55. Who band together, help one another, draw from services and resources, and we also enjoy social connections and activities and lifelong learning. And we're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year, and as part of that, we are super excited to offer this free event on ageism. The topic itself is in perfect alignment with everything that we have valued since day one, which, as Dr. Kep shared is the contributions, the opportunities, and the growth that together we can make with one another. We age better together. And one thing that SAIL has, as I said from the beginning, we partner with the members. So as staff, it is not a traditional consumer or clinical type of relationship. We partner with the members. And together we accomplish helping people stay and at home, age healthy, safely at home, but most importantly, create connections. And this is our theme this year, connections. And so offering this event helps us connect more widely with the community, not just internally with membership and those we're associated with. The event will include table discussions along with presentations by Dr. Kep and also Sam Wilson, who is with AARP. And the table discussions will be facilitated by several community partners. And these are people in Dane County. We are rich with resources, and we have many aging colleagues, aging services colleagues, who are assisting with this workshop to help facilitate table discussions and where we can hear from the participants. All ages are welcome, and it's really important to register in advance. We have about 50 spaces left, so are hoping, and you can register by clicking on sailtoday.org website.
S-A-I-L?
S-A-I-L-today.org. Or calling 608-230-4321.
And we'll give that again as we move along today. Mm-hmm. Talking today with Dr. Regina Kep, a clinical geropsychologist and the founder and director of Center for Mental Health and Aging based in Atlanta and Georgia. Ann Elbert, executive director of Age Better Incorporated in Madison. I'm Larry Miller for WPR News. Along about 11:45, we'll talk about how voice disorders are treated with a couple of faculty members from the UW Department of Otolaryngology. Then at 12:30, we'll talk about personalized cell therapy treatments for cancer and other diseases. That's a fascinating subject as well. But the fascinating subject we're dealing with right now is ageism with our two guests, Dr. Regina Kep and Ann Elbert. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Got an experience you want to share? I hope you will. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Sue in Eau Claire. Sue, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a nurse practitioner with geriatric specialty for many, many years. And I just wanted to make a comment that I think some of the problems with elders not speaking up or you're not being able to really help them mentally is that we don't try to figure out where they're coming from. If we find out what they're really interested in, rather than just offering a simple craft that makes paper door decorations or something like that, that's just below what their capabilities truly are, it'll make a huge difference in getting their involvement. If we find out who they are and what makes them tick, there's all kinds of things that will work. So thank you for taking that.
Sue, thanks for calling. And have you both comment. Ann, start with you.
I think she's absolutely right, the caller. I absolutely believe that. We, for example, when people join our organization, one of the first things we do is a new member visit. And it's an opportunity to meet the person and get to know them and inquire more about what their interests are. But on a day-to-day basis, I think we need to do better with that because there are definitely, we all have passions and they continue regardless of our age. And being able to express that is super important.
Yeah, I would think so. I can think about talking with somebody who's spent 30 years in a particular field of study or work, just to give a talk on it, and maybe teach a class related to it. Yeah,
right.
I think that makes good sense. Dr. Kemp, comments?
Well, I think, Sue, the caller is exactly right. Getting to know the person before you prescribe an activity is important. And just to relate it back to ageism can include paternalizing behavior, assuming you know better for the person than they know for themselves, and treating them like they're incapable or a child. You know, we infantilize older people, and that is a manifestation of ageism. And one way to counter that is to do what Sue was suggesting, is to get to know the person and understand who the person is, what their interests are, what fuels them, what drives them, what would bring them a mission-filled, purpose-filled life, and go with what they want and not what you assume they want.
All good points. I'm wondering, having just gone through some times with my brother, who actually passed away here several months back, but he was an older guy, and in dealing, you know, I went through a lot of ups and downs, actually, dealing with him. And I'm wondering, how should we think differently about aging, especially for those of us who are caregivers for maybe siblings or parents or grandparents? I think I have thoughts from both of you on that. Anne, you want to start?
Yeah, I think that it's important to take the time and to try to focus on the abilities or the ways that you can engage together. And, you know, kind of be creative, be open to being creative with how you might go about that. I think a lot of a member we have who's 104 years old, and she cannot drive. She decided to give up driving. and she has other friends that she'd like to see. It's not good to be, you know, she likes to be with people. And so she ended up having a friend, a handyman that helps her out, organize picking up some friends to come over and visit. So, you know, she really took charge of that. And I think it's really important to, again, not take over necessarily or assume that somebody can't take part in creating an opportunity like that. And so I always kind of refer to it as that person calling the shots, so to speak, you know, being able to organize things or come up with ideas.
Good points. Dr. Kemp, comments?
Well, Larry, first, I'm so sorry for the loss of your brother. And I think caregivers face unique and complex challenges that nobody can really understand until they're in the middle of it. I think it just has so many dilemmas and complexities. You're navigating what's potentially best for your brother and yourself, and there are a lot of competing demands. I'll say, sometimes when we are bearing witness and caregiving we're bearing witness to another person's suffering, it can become very overwhelming for our own lives. And having our own caregivers as a caregiver is key, that we are shoring ourselves up with other supports and resources, because just as the population is aging, so too are the number of caregivers, because as we age, we do become more physically vulnerable, and we do become more vulnerable to medical problems, and we will need care and caregiving. And that's a reality that comes with growing older. And that is not the only reality that comes with growing older. So I would also say there are three other important aspects to growing older, four total. There's the physical, which tends to decline with age. There's psychological, spiritual, and social aspects of growing older as well that can actually evolve and deepen. And so often in society, and for caregivers in particular, the focus is on the physical because it is what is the most pressing concern. And like Anne was talking about, we can also attend to these other parts of our life that we can cultivate and strengthen, which are the psychological resiliencies, friendships, and even our spirituality and what brings us a sense of purpose in the world, even if we're living with a life-altering medical condition or we're caregiving for somebody. And many caregivers I've worked with will say caregiving was the hardest thing that they've ever done, and they would do it all over again, because even though it is filled with a lot of stress and bearing witness to suffering and putting your life, what feels like a life, on hold, it also comes with a deep sense of meaning and purpose for many caregivers. And so if folks are listening who are caregivers, please get support for yourself so you can do the hard and necessary work of caregiving and be clear about your boundaries in the caregiving relationship. And that will change over time and fluctuate. Like you mentioned, Larry, the ups and downs.
Tony in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you all today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Actually, I just wanted to, I agree with all the psychological and emotional and physical barriers and challenges that come with caregiving. I just wanted to touch on the financial part of things. My mom is going to be 98 years old, and I've been very much taking care of her back and forth for more years than I can count now. And none of us were born with golden spoons, and so it's pretty financially draining as a caregiver when you don't have the ability to bring in an income and pad your retirement. And it can actually put some pretty significant financial challenges on yourself, just because I'm trying to get her to keep as much independence as possible. So she does live in not any kind of assisted living or anything, but it is a place for seniors. And but I am back and forth there 7 days a week, and extra meals and extra running, and as much time as I possibly can give between 1 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock is when I have time for myself. And so realistically, just even keeping your vehicle going with that kind of extra pull out of your household, it can be pretty challenging in that direction.
Yeah. Tony, thanks a lot for calling. I'll get comments probably from both. Dr. Kapp, we'll start with you this time. Go ahead.
You are so right about the financial realities and challenges of caregiving. And caregiving can last for years to decades. And also, depending on the illness, some illnesses require more resources than others to provide care for. And it can have tremendous consequence for families financially. I think this is where policy is really important, to like Medicaid and Medicare policies, and making sure we're considering that when we go to the voting polls, what's important to you about policies that will impact caregiving down the road. I'd say we should all be concerned about policies impacting caregiving now and down the road, policies impacting places that people can afford to live when they need assistance or assisted living, personal care homes, room and board homes. I think that's critical when we're talking about caregiving, is what resources are available financially. And because most caregivers work or need to continue working, I think close to 2/3 of caregivers work full time. And so it is an impossible position for caregivers to be in. The more the caregiving needs increase, the less the person can work, because somebody's life is literally in your hands. And so we really need to be thinking about this at a systemic level with policy and protecting people and making sure we have resources to support families.
Yeah. Anne, anything to add there?
Well, I totally agree. I think that it is very challenging. And we do often refer people to the aging and disability resource centers. They have benefits specialists. Some people aren't aware of maybe some of the programs that are available, but it definitely we need to advocate with the policies. That makes a huge difference for all of us.
And thinking not only of the caregivers, Tony, thanks, and good for you for the work that you've done with your mom. I can feel a little bit what it takes based on my own experiences, but not to the extent that you have. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm wondering, just for the person, the elderly or the older person who is fine and trying to live independently, but financially for that person, it's also a problem. I mean, you're limited. You can be limited if you've retired. You can be quite limited in what you can do. Would you talk about that a little bit, Dr. Kemp?
Sure. Yes. So our opportunities for making money do become more limited. Either physically, we may not be as mobile to participate in the workplace as we once were. And then, of course, ageism. Even if you do want to participate in the workplace, ageism might be a barrier in your finding work. I know many older adults who actually go back to work after retirement for financial reasons and for supplemental insurance to cover what Medicare doesn't cover for them or their family members. And so I think that the financial concerns for older people in general are very important. Also, we're living longer. So the older adulthood for research purposes starts at 65, and really we start it when people become eligible for Social Security. So older adulthood might shift to 67, but right now it's 65, and people can live from 65 to 122. And so that is close to 60 years.
Yeah, you're halfway through life.
Yeah. And so that's a long time to, if you want to work, to be discriminated against at work, to be overlooked for positions, or if you're not able to work or are of retirement age and want to enjoy other aspects of your life beyond work, then maybe you're very limited in the range that you have access to outside of your community or even with driving, as the caller, Tony, was talking about.
Yeah, it's... I'm trying to. Well, I don't think I'm going to make it to 120. I hope I live a long time, but I'm pretty sure I probably won't make it that long. But here's me. I've got a pretty good retirement program. I work for the state. One of the things we did as state workers, we took a little less salary money and put more money, more of our intention into retirement programs. So through life, you don't make quite as much, but then at the end of life, you have a lot better. And so I feel really, really lucky to be where I am in my situation. But I full know well that so many people are not in that kind of situation, Anne.
I agree. I think... fortunately, we do live in, I can speak to Dane County in this community, a wonderful community with many resources. It's really important for all of us to be aware of what's out there and to take part. And then if we're able to support some of these resources, that can help ease some of that financial stress, thinking about things like transportation and things that volunteers can help with. It goes back to being, an advocate in terms of policy, all of that, but also really living in community, whether it is you as a person drawing on some of the resources, such as volunteer support, or you are providing it and or funding. We are in this together, and this is an unprecedented time where we have the amount or the number of people growing older and maybe with children who are retired, for example.
Mark in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Larry. I have a personal experience. My mother got Alzheimer's. She's passed away since. But my wife and I moved up in 2011 to Wausau to take care of her. In the process, we got a hold of a book that's utterly fantastic, ties in excellently with what everybody's been saying. I'm wondering if all of you have heard of it. It's called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Dementia Ward. A local writer wrote it because he started working at our local health facility. And it's just fantastic. He just showed the value of getting to know even people with Alzheimer's, their background, and learning to work with them and how much better it was when you did that.
Oh.
I've not heard of that. Thank you.
Dr. Kemp, have you heard? A funny thing happened on the way to the dementia ward.
I also haven't heard of it, but I'm going to check it out.
I am too.
But the message that Mark shared, which is to really get to know the person, is key. And I couldn't agree more, because so often when people are living with conditions like Alzheimer's disease, we look only at the illness, and it's hard to see the person who's covered or shrouded by the illness. And Mark's reminder to look for the person and look and be curious about what they are interested in, who they are, their family life, what inspired them, and find ways to incorporate that into their world is really key. So I thank you, Mark, for reminding us of that message.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mark. I want to go back to the event that's coming up for those tuning in late. Maybe you've got a free event in Madison next week. It's focused on this issue. And tell us about it.
Okay. The name of the event is Flip the Script on Aging. And it's happening on Wednesday, October 22nd at 1:30, from 1:30 to 4 p.m. at Madison Marriott West. And to register, you can call 608-230-4321 or click on sailtoday.org, sailtoday.org on our website. We have some spaces left. We have limited space left, so we encourage people to register. We ask you to please register in advance. And we look forward to a very dynamic presentation and wonderful discussions.
And Dr. Kemp, you're going to be talking. Tell us what you're going to be speaking about at the event.
Yeah, so we'll be talking about how to shift your mindset to be more pro-aging and less ageist. And so we'll be talking a little bit about what we talked about today, as well as what we can do about ageism when we see it happening, like to just draw our attention to an awareness to ageist thoughts. So if somebody says something that's ageist, or you yourself think something that's ageist, to drawing awareness to it, to being open to changing it and to challenging it. And so we'll talk about the impact of ageism on physical health and mental health, like we touched on here. We'll talk about what older adulthood brings. So often when we talk about aging, we talk about negative aspects of aging, and there are so many positive aspects of aging. Like older adults are, per research, better problem solvers. We have a greater sense of self-compassion. We have more wisdom, a better sense of emotion regulation, and so looking at one thing I say is when we only focus on what is wrong, we miss what is strong. And so, yes, while we do have physical changes that come, we do become more medically vulnerable. That is a reality of growing older. We also become psychologically and spiritually and socially stronger. And so focusing also on cultivating what is strong and what we can evolve with is what we'll be talking about as well.
It sounds absolutely great, and you two have the kind of energy and enthusiasm that brings out that makes me want to attend for sure. I want to go back to that book that was mentioned. The title of it is "A Funny Thing Happened on My Way to the Dementia Ward," and it's subtitled "A Memoir of a Male CNA." So there's that as well. So, all right, you want to hear some more from Ann and from Dr. Kapp? I hope you'll sign up for this event. Flip the Script on Aging, right?
Right.
Script on Aging, and it's coming up October 22nd. And go to sailtoday.org, and you're going to find out how to register. And you need to register.
Yes,
right?
Yes, we need you to register.
But it's a free event.
It is free, yeah, definitely.
But I understand why you would need to register.
Yes.
For sure. Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today. It's been very instructive to me, and I think to our listeners as well, and really appreciate not only being with us today, but the work that you do, because it's very important work, and I'm glad you're keeping it up. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Regina Kapp is a clinical geropsychologist and the founder and director of the Center for Mental Health and Aging in Atlanta, Georgia. Ann Elbert is executive director of Age Better Incorporated, located in Madison. It's great to have both of them with us. And you know what? We'll probably be doing this topic again down the road. I'm pretty sure we will. Up next, we're going to talk about voice disorders and how they are treated with two faculty members in the Department of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, there's been a time or two when I have had to call in my executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and said, I can't do the show today because I don't have a voice. And it hurts sometimes. And if you've ever experienced pain when trying to speak, you certainly don't take your voice for granted, believe me. Today we'll talk about the treatment for larynx disorders with a couple of guests at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. There's a pretty new department of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and we'll talk to two faculty members who are part of that program. Joining us, Dr. Sandra Lin, a professor and chair of the department. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you with us. Dr. Susan Thiebold is an endowed professor and vice chair for research in the Department of Otolaryngology. And Dr. Susan Thiebold, welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
As we talk with our two guests, they're both within the Department of Otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, of course. And as we talk about voice disorders, what's going on there, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Have you had difficulty speaking? Was it the result of illness or maybe an injury? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dr. Lin, you're the head person.
Yes.
So you must have a definition for otolaryngology. A few people have trouble pronouncing that anyway.
Yeah. So in lay terms, many people call us ear, nose, and throat, but we're much broader than that, as Dr. Thiebold can attest to. While we're a clinical department treating all kinds of ear, nose, and throat disorders, one of the things we do as an academic department in the medical school is really train the future generation. So when you just heard the aging and ageism, that we have people to take care of the next generation and myself. We are training physicians. We're training speech language pathologists. We're training the new scientists for the next generation. So that's very important training. And also we're doing really high-level research at the University of Wisconsin, especially in our department. So I'm very proud of the group, and it's a privilege, really, to help these people be more successful.
It's great to have this department. Dr. Susan Thibault, how many people, you know, do you have to deal with, or maybe how many people maybe in Wisconsin or across the country might suffer from voice issues of one sort or another?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's estimated that about 1 in 13 people at any time have a voice problem. And then about 30% of the population will have a voice problem over the course of their lifetime.
So that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, yes.
And it's important, I mean, in terms of the quality of life, mm-hmm. is it not?
It's exceptionally so, and most people don't recognize how important their voice is until they actually lose it or have difficulty using it. We know that people who use their voice for work, such as radio broadcasters, teachers, ministers, lawyers, they are at a much higher risk of having a voice disorder than someone who may not talk as much at work, for example. But it affects every aspect of one's life, definitely.
I'm wondering, what are the most common problems that typically come up?
So more often than not, it's excessive voice use that causes problems with a voice disorder. However, it can range from a neurological problem to cancer to overuse to an injury after surgery. Sometimes we don't know even why someone will have a problem with their voice.
It's amazing. I always watch the basketball games, and afterward, many basketball games, and afterwards the coach will be interviewed. Mm-hmm. And it was like, the person can hardly talk anymore, and you wonder what effect something like that can have on your voice over time. It's constant shouting and hollering, Dr. Lynn.
So that's a great example, and one of the things, for example, we see in children, vocal cord nodules. They sound like they're 40-pack year smokers, and they are like a 5-year-old. And that is an example of voice misuse in children. They want to be heard. And so that's an example. But also adults can develop things like nodules or polyps from misuse, and other like lifestyle factors can contribute, things like alcohol, smoking.
Vaping.
Yeah. Stomach vaping. Reflux.
Yeah. Yeah. Vaping is just as serious as smoking with its effect on the voice.
Samantha in Whitehall has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Samantha.
Yes, hi. This is Samantha from Whitehall. I was just wondering, I had an uncle that he passed away some quite a few years ago now, 2017, but he had an undiagnosed disability where it was hard for him to talk. He just didn't. The more he started to talk or tried to get something out, the harder it was, and he would stutter. Now, he died at 75 years old, but what would you do with people like that today that they shouldn't do too much, even 40, 50, 60 years ago?
Thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry to hear about that, your family member's prior struggles. I think one thing is we really have to have a better understanding. There could be many disorders that could cause these types of symptoms. One, like a neurologic one called spasmodic dysphonia, other things, even things like a stroke and have trouble vocal processing and producing speech. My own father had Parkinson's disease, and before he passed, really hard for him just to get the words out. So there are things that we can do, but at first it starts with a correct diagnosis, and then like Dr. Thibault's speech language pathologist, as well as a world renowned researcher, are key in helping make the diagnosis and treatment. in conjunction with an ear, nose, and throat physician. So number one, you'd have to figure out what is the exact cause. And there are things that we are able to offer, say, in, and even in the office that, okay, I'm a little older than, you know, in a little gray hair here. But things that we used to do in the operating room, such as Botox injections for spasmodic dysphonia, we do those in the clinic now. You also can do fillers for vocal cords, you know, kind of like fillers in your face. Mm-hmm. That used to be done in the operating room. And now it's amazing that we can do these things without general anesthesia, with just some topical anesthesia in the office, and produce really great results. So we're making progress.
Making progress. We have some more callers online. Ralph is on the road heading to northern Wisconsin. Ralph, what's on your mind?
I have a question about one of President Trump's cabinet members, who is RFK Jr. His voice is terrible. I'm just wondering if your panel knows what caused that.
Yes, he has spasmodic dysphonia, which is a neurological voice disorder. It's a type of dystonia that affects specifically the vocal folds and the larynx. There are a number of treatments that improves the quality of the voice. It can never go away per se, but there's multiple treatments like Botox that Dr. Lynn had mentioned. I want to say I feel like Senator Kennedy went to Japan and had a surgery, which they do in Japan that's different than what we do in the U.S. And it, as we can hear, it may not have been as successful as we had hoped. But there are many different treatments we can do. And I want to say there was actually a very famous radio broadcaster, yes, who has had spasmodic dysphonia.
I think someone in NPR. And yeah. That had been years ago. That.
Oh, what's her name? Diane. Okay, well.
Anyway,
he has spasmodic dysphonia.
Ralph, there you go. Thanks for calling. And yeah, well, let's go to Kathy in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I am a voice teacher in Madison and a singer. And my first experience with the UW was through my teacher at the university, who was associated with Diane Bless. She was a therapist out there, and we got to visit the voice clinic and get scoped. They looked at our vocal cords. It was very exciting. I myself have been a patient there. In 2015, I had a vocal cord hemorrhage, which was very frightening and, you know, was really horrible to look at. And I'm fully recovered from it. I followed the directions and was on vocal rest for a time, and couldn't teach, couldn't sing, but that was okay because it all came out okay in the end. So I'm just amazed at the resiliency of the vocal mechanism and the vocal cords in particular. And I'm also just amazed at what is going on at UW. I've sent students to the clinic. I have friends who've had surgery there. And in most cases, everything came out okay. So thank you for your continued work and service to the voice community, which is important.
Thank you, Kathy, thank you for calling. Dr. Lynn?
I just wanted to mention Dr. Diane Bless. She retired, but is still very active, and she received the Wisconsin Medical Alumni Association Award for her contributions. She was really instrumental in setting up not only the vocal clinic with Dr. Chuck Ford, who is a laryngologist, a specialized otolaryngologist, but she really helped set up the research portion as well. So,
yeah, and if I could just add, our voice clinic started back in the 80s under the supervision of Chuck Ford and Diane Bless, and it was the first in the country to have a model where the patient is seen by a team of experts, by a laryngologist as well as a speech pathologist. That model is now used throughout the country, and we initiated that here in Madison.
And we'll talk some more about that with our two guests. So we're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. And then we'll be back with Dr. Sandra Lynn and Dr. Susan Thibault. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
It's almost noon, and another hour of the Larry Mueller Show is coming up on WPR News. After Larry, On Point starts today at 1, followed by The World. At 3, All Things Considered brings you the latest from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio.
The nation's special education services are targeted with sweeping layoffs by the Trump administration.
On Wisconsin Today, hear from a special education director on how Wisconsin kids could be affected.
And Green Bay hosts the World Street Fishing Championship. Members of Team USA introduce us to the growing sport.
No boats, no electronics. Nearly everything you can catch with an artificial bait counts.
Coming up tonight at 7, right after Marketplace on WPR News.
This is WPR News.
Talking today about medical treatment for the larynx, also known as your voice box, and some of us make a living by talking, and in addition to radio talk show hosts like me, we've got teachers, pastors, singers. Most of us depend on being able to be heard, so if your job requires you to speak up and you suddenly can't, good to know there are some solutions. Larry Mueller here. With us today, Dr. Sandra Lin, a professor and chair of the new Department of Otolaryngology in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Also with us today, Susan Thibault, who is an endowed professor and vice chair for research in the Department of Otolaryngology. What questions do you have about how to take care of your voice or when surgery should be considered? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. We're talking right now about voice disorders and treatment for them with our two guests, Dr. Sandra Lin, professor and chair of the new Department of Otolaryngology in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and with her, Dr. Susan Thibault, an endowed professor and vice chair for research in the Department of Otolaryngology. Great to have both of them with us, and I hope you'll join in. You can have your voice heard as well. Give us a call. Problems associated with your voice or with perhaps someone you know, I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. And let's talk about your new department, Dr. Lin. You're you're both faculty members in it. Talk about the focus of the department.
Yeah, so we have several. We're going to talk about the clinical subspecialties, meaning we're ear, nose, and throat doctors. We have a comprehensive group, which are more general, and then we have subspecialists. So the one that works with our speech-language pathologists are ear, nose, and throat doctors that had extra training. They're called laryngologists. We have facial plastic surgeons. We have head and neck cancer and reconstructive surgeons, pediatric ear, nose, and throat surgeons, sinus specialized and skull-based surgeons, and brain and ear neurotology. So we have a breadth at Wisconsin. We serve a lot of people in the state and actually beyond the state with the types of things that we're treating, and we also do research in.
You were all here, or most of you were here, but putting it together as a department, why was that important?
Well, otolaryngology, or ear, nose, and throat's been part of University of Wisconsin since the 1930s, but never his own department. And we've been part of the Department of Surgery for a long time. But I think becoming a department is important because just like any group, we have greater self-determination of our goals, our strategy, how we want to use resources to further our mission. And when we talk about mission, it's excellent patient care, pushing forth scientific discovery, and training the next generation. So it's really important for us to do that, especially in this day and age. People might be hearing things about we're affected by things like federal funding and stuff, so that we can really determine and make the decisions as a group.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Dr. Thibault, let's take an example. I understand that that members of your department have helped American Players theater actors.
Yes.
And Madison Opera singers protect their voices. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so with APT for many years, at the beginning of a season in May, we would have the company come as well as their permanent and non-permanent members. We would give them lectures on how to care for their voice, especially in the outdoor environment. We would do baseline laryngoscopy, which is actually looking at their vocal folds and mm-hmm. seeing if they have any problems or if they're normal, and recording that. So they actually have that as a baseline as well. In the sense, if, you know, 6 weeks into their performing, if they're having difficulties, we can compare and contrast. Madison Opera, we have a relationship with, for example. Every time an opera is here, the visiting performers, if they are having problems, we see them as well. Hopefully we don't see them because they don't, you know, the opera performers come in for a couple weeks at a time to practice ahead of time and then actually just stay for the performance, and then they move on to their next performance, and hopefully they don't have any issues, but certainly we have seen them if they have had problems, definitely.
Singing about APT, because you're outside and they need to project their voices.
Mm-hmm. They need to project their voices. They do have microphones, but still, it could be humid, it could be raining, it could be cold, it could be hot, it could be dry. All of those environmental conditions affect our voice as we breathe and sing or talk. So we help them with understanding how to best take care of the voice, how to best project so they're not actually causing damage to their vocal folds is also very important.
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm wondering, what diseases typically cause voice problems? Are there diseases that...
So there's human papillomavirus, which causes RRP, or respiratory recurrent papillomatosis of the vocal folds. That is relatively one of the more common voice disorders.
The more serious ones would be cancers of the vocal cord or surrounding areas. Sometimes this is why it's important if you've had persistent hoarseness for more than 6 to 8 weeks and it's not getting better, and you don't think it's just a cold, that to get it checked out. Because if you can catch that cancer early, it's a much easier way to treat it than if you let, like anything else, than if you let it go. But that's probably one of the more serious things that we see is the cancer of the vocal cord or glottic area.
I was also going to suggest or say that so people will have thyroid cancer, and where the thyroid is positioned in the neck, it can affect the nerve that controls the opening and closing of the vocal folds. And so often someone's first sign that they're having difficulty with their thyroid may indeed be a paralysis or a hoarseness. Also, having that removed can cause a damage to the nerve and can cause a paralysis and or paresis of that vocal cord. So thyroid cancer is actually relatively common as well.
Yeah, thyroid surgery, carotid surgery is in that same area, mm-hmm. some heart surgeries, and also just surgery, because when they put the breathing tube in, that can cause some temporary problems with voice or some other issues that might need treatment from a specialist.
Yeah, I want to talk some more about the cancer treatments, but we have some questions here. We'll get some folks online. Jean in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jean, what's on your mind?
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Paradoxical vocal fold syndrome. I have it, and it's super scary. Can you talk a little bit about it? I've had episodes where I totally cannot breathe. I use pursed breathing, but it is like, please talk about it and tell me if there's some new help for me.
Jean, thank you very much for calling. Well, let's turn to Dr. Thiebel.
Yeah, so paradoxical vocal fold motion, it's also, I mean, has many names. More recently, the appropriate terminology is, the acronym is called ILO, induced laryngeal obstruction. And what it is when you're breathing in, instead of the vocal folds opening, they actually close. Ooh. So then you have a sense of struggling to breathe because you're not able to get that breath in. The most common treatment is voice therapy with a speech language pathologist, exactly what you're describing. It's a type of breathing exercise as well as some relaxation techniques. I'm assuming you've had therapy since you've done pursed breathing. And if you haven't, I would recommend that you go back for some therapy for that. You want to make sure that indeed your vocal folds are observed. To make sure that there's nothing else going on with ILO.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the one other thing I would suggest.
So if you haven't been there, or maybe you've been there but haven't been there for a while, it might be worth it. Well, mm-hmm. It sounds like it's worth a trip back,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
To get that looked at again, Jean, and maybe get some more practice with the expert. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Elna in Madison. Hi, Elna.
Hi there. I wondered if you could offer me some insight into why I can't carry a tune. I can hear the notes. I know what it's supposed to sound like. As far as I know, I have no physical disorder, but the sounds that come out don't match the notes.
So singing is like any, it's an exercise, right? Or it's something that some people, number one, have the biological mechanism. Their vocal folds are particularly, have the right structure. You have the right anatomy of the upper airway, which gives you the resonance and subsequently the quality of your voice. But singing is really an exercise, right? And we have people who are naturally good at running and with training become world-class runners. And we have people who are naturally good singers and then with, you know, coaching and practice are excellent singers. And it's the same thing. So I'm not, you know, there's certainly the adage that some people may be tone deaf, but I suspect if you wanted to sing and get better, I would go and see someone who specializes in singing, like a singing coach or something like that. But the reason why is probably just, you know, you probably haven't done it enough or done it with the right instruction.
Elna, I have the same disorder. And everyone in my family would tell you so.
But there is hope on that. I mean, there are music voice instructors, mm-hmm. who can actually work with anybody, and they're happy to work with anybody, regardless if they can carry a tune or not.
I mean, there's voice teachers. There's Association of Voice Teachers, VATS. I mean, being a voice teacher, singing coach is a profession. There's many people who have studied to do that, and there's other people who haven't. But, you know, even, I mean, Adele, all the famous singers have voice coaches they see. So
even though they're really good to begin
yes,
with.
Yes, they are.
Well,
yeah.
Like, you know, the people like Serena Williams, she's got a tennis coach, right?
Right.
She's the best, you know, and they still need a coach.
Right. And to plug the music school here at UW, we have an amazing music school, and there's many voice professors there as well as vocal coaches there.
There you go. Let's turn to an email from Harold in Waupaca. What would cause a hoarse voice after drinking cold liquids or entering a cold air-conditioned room? So, Harold, apparently, if he drinks a cold beer or something, it affects his voice. It causes his voice to be a little hoarse. Would there be something with freezing up the vocal cords?
So I'll say that the vocal folds are actually like temperature-wise precisely measured, and there has been studies that have shown, like, if someone's inhaling heat or cold, does that change the temperature of the vocal folds? And indeed, it does not, because it's they're far enough down into your throat that they don't change temperature with exposure to heat or cold.
Interesting.
It's hard to know exactly what Harold is describing. If indeed is he coughing when he's swallowing, he may be getting, he may not be fully swallowing the liquid, and indeed that's causing a hoarseness because the liquid is sitting on top of the vocal folds and they create that kind of, you know, sound of, you know, liquid being there. And I would suggest he should swallow after he drinks something. If he continues to be concerned, I would highly recommend him going to see a medical professional.
And maybe with the cold air, sometimes it's very dry.
Good point.
And so, you know, I think your vocal cords, like other parts of your body, do best at a certain range of humidity.
Yeah.
So that could be, you know, we live in a colder, drier climate in this part of the country. So some people may experience that in the wintertime. They're a little more forced.
Yeah. Like this studio.
Like this studio.
It's good, dry and cold. Oh, my goodness. Tom and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for a great show. I think a lot of people don't believe they can sing because some teacher in third grade told them they couldn't. I've been a singer my whole life, and I never took voice lessons until I was over 50. And I've done amazing things with the training I've gotten since. If that one caller is from Madison, I highly recommend Dr. Melanie Kane with Fresca Opera and Haven Vocal Arts. She's made a phenomenal singer out of me, taking me to places I never thought I could go. Gilbert and Sullivan, light opera, all kinds of things.
Wow.
Wow.
There are people out there. Yeah, there are people that can definitely help you.
Very, very well put, Tom. And so there's another vote for getting someone to give you some voice lessons. All right. We've got a question from, I'm not sure who, about the effects of inhalants. And you did mention that.
Just inhalants in general?
Like smoking,
Smoking and baking.
And vaping.
Yeah, so smoking and vaping are, I mean, well known to cause, well, smoking has well documented to cause cancer of the vocal folds. And if you're a smoker and you're hoarse, I would highly recommend you see a physician. Vaping is also, you know, you're inhaling a lot of chemicals, and the research is it's too young in the field, but we do know that indeed in some of the basic science models that it increases mucus, it increases inflammation in that tissue. So it's more than, I mean, I would suggest as well is if you're vaping a lot and you have hoarseness to see a physician to rule out cancer. Those are both, so the effects of those inhalants are actually very
well known
and can be serious.
Yeah.
Some inhalants can also cause ILO, which is a previous caller called about. If someone has an allergy or they're affected by different smells or inhalants, the vocal folds could actually rapidly shut, and then you can have difficulty breathing.
Ralph in Eau Claire has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ralph.
Hello. My question may not pertain to voice, but I have trouble getting medications down my windpipe, and it's a lot of coughing, and it's happened four times since the 4th of July, and I'm still coughing, getting things up out of my lungs. Is there something wrong, or what should I do?
I guess I'll start with that. What you're describing is, you know, difficulty swallowing pills, and we call that dysphagia. Mm-hmm. And some people have it with liquids and solids. It's a very common complaint with pills. And there could be many things contributing, so that's why it is important, if it is bothersome and persistent, that you talk first with your primary care, because there just like we were talking about voice disorders, there can be many different reasons for it. And yeah. And before you can have a cure, you need to figure out the reason. So, Susan, did you have anything to
add?
Yeah,
no, I was just going to say there's, it's called dysphagia. It could be for many reasons. It could be for sensation. It could be a nerve issue. It could be normal aging. But it would be important to have that looked at. If it's happened four times since July, I would say that's more than normal and would recommend you see a professional.
Yeah, there you go, Ralph. Thank you very much for calling. Susan, could you talk about your research? What's the focus of your research?
So my research in general looks at vocal fold biology and the mucosa of the vocal fold tissue. And I try to understand how that it responds to things like cigarette smoke and inflammation. We are trying to regenerate that tissue in the labs. Maybe if I can branch out a bit, I can talk about the fact that in Madison, we actually have a large consortium of people who study voice. Our research is funded by the National Institutes of Health. We have a large enough consortium of people that we've been able to apply for and get what's called a T32, which is a training grant specifically in the area of voice and voice disorders, and it's the only one that's funded by the NIH in the U.S. And that's because we have enough people here who study voice and are funded themselves by the NIH that we can apply for this. So we train the next generation of pre-docs, post-docs, residents in this area, and that's a substantial feat. And if I can expand that just a little bit more to the whole department, our department has been actively doing research for many, many years at UW-Madison. And as we become a new department, departments are often ranked on how much funding they have from the National Institutes of Health. And with us being a new department, we will immediately go within the top 10 programs in this country with the amount of funding we have.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
I certainly believe that would be a nice feather in the cap.
Yeah, well, it's a feather in the cap, and it's recognition of all the hard work that everybody in our department are doing. They're doing studying things to better, you know, health of people or cure disease in people. And the thing is, it takes a lot of research to move the needle a little bit.
Yeah. Where do you see the research going or larynx treatment going in the future?
Well, I can talk more about maybe clinical things. I mean, things that in general we're using more clinically, we'll be maybe using more AI and diagnosis, having more office-based care, which I talked about, a lot of more office-based treatments that we used to do in the operating room. In some of the other areas, not specifically in voice, there was increasing use of, you know, some type of robotics. I'm branching out more beyond the voice, and we're also in our group studying how to regenerate hearing in a different way. So there's a lot going on, and we are really fortunate that we have a group of people kind of at the forefront of a lot of areas. But Susan, if you want to talk more specifically about voice research, that's going.
So there's, for example, the very first medication for RRP has just been approved by the FDA, and that's available for injections for those patients, and it's an exceptionally debilitating disease. So that's a really important brand new advancement that has just come out. There's certainly a lot of work on transplantation of the larynx or transplantation of different parts of that tissue, That being done in Madison is a huge transplant center, as you've probably interviewed those people. Different medications used for inflammation beyond steroids. And we're looking a lot at the microbiome, for example, and what bacteria is there and how that is involved with inflammatory reactions. So different medications, different surgical approaches, and then different therapy approaches as well.
Well, it has been wonderful talking with you today. We should have you back and do this. I mean, I wanted to talk a little more about cancer and how you deal with that. So maybe we can come back and talk about
We have definitely
we've got great cancer colleagues that would come.
This is a big, we have the Carbone Cancer Center. Our head and neck cancer colleagues are doing a huge service to the state. We are very, very busy. Yeah. And we have what's called a, one of the very few SPOR grants that means we're, because we're such a great team and a team at doing research, recognized, it's again federally funded, to study just head and neck cancer. And that's with our radiation oncologist, our medical oncologist, and our head and neck cancer surgeon. So we're very proud. I think there's only maybe two left in the country.
Two or three.
Mm-hmm. And so we're happy to bring them back, bring some of my other people here.
In the meantime, thank you both very much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure. Dr. Sandra Lynn, Dr. Susan Thibault, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about your work. It's fascinating stuff, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Well, we're going to turn our attention next to cell therapy. And our next guest knows a lot about it, Dr. Jock Gallipo, practicing hematologist and professor of oncology, our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. We're turning our attention now to cell therapy. It involves manipulating cells so that they fight disease more effectively. The cells can come from a transplant donor, or if you're the patient, maybe from yourself. And it can be a powerful alternative, perhaps, or an adjunct to drug treatment. We're going to talk about that today with Dr. Jacques Gallipo, who is a practicing hematologist, professor of oncology. He's associate dean for therapeutics development and director of the program for advanced cell therapy. Program for Advanced Cell Therapy. We can call it PACT, I guess, is the acronym for that. It's a collaboration between UW Health and the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about cell therapy as a means of treating disease? Do you wonder if you could benefit maybe from cell therapy? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Jacques Gallipo, thank you for joining us today.
Larry, delight to be here.
So, how does cell therapy work?
So, everybody's familiar with pills. Yeah, you go to Walgreens, you know, over-the-counter tablets. That's medicinal chemistry. Maybe 40 years ago, a new technology came up, proteins as a therapeutic, you know, injecting synthetic insulin. That's a good example.
Okay.
That's not a small molecule. It's not a synthetic. It's a protein. The next thing that was launched was actually built upon a discovery made here in Madison, which was, you must have heard of Jamie Thompson.
Of course. I interviewed Jamie Thompson more than once.
There you go. So Jamie put Madison on the map internationally because he MacGyvered a method to generate a type of stem cell that it had the ability to turn into brain cells, insulin-producing cells, you name it, anything. So that technological breakthrough launched 1,000 ships because now you could think about cells as a means to treat disorders that had unmet needs. There was no remedy. And the way to think about cells is, you know, you hear about robots and sci-fi movies and nanobots and
that. Yeah.
Cells are these incredible machines that have evolved over a billion years that are in your body, and they're types of cells that have developed specific functionalities that we can take them, put them in a Petri dish, jazz them up in such a way that they're 10 times better at what they're doing, and we can give them back to you. So as you pointed out, Larry, I can take cells from somebody else. You've heard bone marrow transplants, that sort of kind of, or like organ transplant. I could take your own cells, and they're different cells from different sources that have different clinical use cases. So this platform does stuff that pills and biologics can't do. And I'll give you a salient example. You can take, you know, Jamie's stem cells or other cells that are similar. And in a Petri dish, I can convert them into pancreas insulin-producing cells. And, you know, if you're a severe diabetic, you can get cured if you get islet cell transplant from a cadaveric donor. You can't take it from a live donor. But it's not, there's not enough donors around to treat, you know, the thousands and thousands of diabetics. But here, you can grow a crop of cells to treat thousands of patients, and you just give them back, and it would replace the pancreas that they lost. Pills can't do that.
No.
So that's just one of the technological platforms we're working on right now, building upon Jamie's seminal technical discovery from 40 years ago. But where we're at right now is the next gen. So you're going to ask me, well, what's the next gen?
Yeah.
So, again, sci-fi movies, you know, genetic engineering. You know, genetic engineering is not sci-fi anymore. I have summer undergrad students that can take cells and change their genetic makeup permanently to make them do what they naturally can't or won't do. So now the only limit to what you can do is your imagination.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Allie and Racine has a question or a comment maybe. Allie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's been any research done on degenerative neurological eye diseases like RP or glaucoma or anything like that.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? Spot on. There's this really bright pediatric ophthalmologist, David Gamm, G-A-M-M. I'm going to call him out. He's at UW. And he's developed a method to take stem cells and turn them into retinal pigmented epithelial cells, RPE for short. And people that have macular degeneration, that's what gets messed up. And that technology was turned into a company that has launched a clinical trial to inject those stem cells to treat macular degeneration. And it's technology that was first born out the research out of UW by David. So, yes, that's going on. Same thing for replacing damaged brain cells that cause Parkinson's. And the same thing for the insulin-producing cells I spoke of. Those are the three platforms that are the most advanced that are currently in ongoing clinical trials worldwide.
And David's been on the show as well. I mean, where are we in that, the clinical trials? Do you know offhand?
So the technology was transferred to a commercial entity. That commercial entity has been able to launch a clinical trial. And I want to say their inaugural case are going to be at the University of Miami. But there are other. That's the first, but there are going to be others. But, yes, they've... That ship has launched.
Dr. Jacques Galipo, our guest today, as we talk with him about the work going on with cells, maybe with your cells at some point in your life. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. So as you say, that research goes back a long ways, at least 40 years, for sure, with Jamie's work. How's the cell therapy program able to accelerate kind of innovation and treatment? I mean...
Yeah, so great point. So the goal of our program is to, with alacrity, bring these platforms to first in human here in Wisconsin. So, of course, we do the mouse stuff, and, you know, we all do, and, you know, but that's a long horizon. That's 5-10 years. I'm talking about in the moment, what can we put into people? And we got, so I've been here, I'm starting my 9th year in Wisconsin. Yeah. And one of our most advanced programs on the heels of your last guest. So hear me out. We take some of your bone marrow, and we can, from that, we grow a crop of specialized marrow stem cells whose job in life is to repair damaged organs. We grow a crop of those. I call them mesenchymal stromal cells, MSCs for short. And what we demonstrated in mice, and then when are currently doing in people, is if you had throat cancer, you were likely, you're going to be cured, most likely, with surgery, chemo, and radiation to your neck and throat. But the radiation that you get to cure your cancer messes up your salivary glands. You don't make saliva anymore. Half the patients wind up with severe dry mouth the rest of their life. Miserable. No approved treatment. What we discovered is if we take your own stem cells, we grow a crop of them, and we inject them in the damaged salivary gland, we rescue its function. And we've treated now 21 patients as part of a clinical trial. Last patient's going to be treated next month. The study's called MARSH, mesenchymal stromal cells for radiation-induced dry mouth. And it's going on right now in Madison. We've got now 3 such FDA licenses. We're the only place in the U.S. that's doing this. We're the only one in the world where we've taken the stem cells and we actually juiced them up using this synthetic hormone to make them more potent, and that's what we're doing right now. That's just one example.
And, all right, so you've treated, I mean, and the results, obviously you haven't finished the whole program with the relating to that, but how does it, I mean, are the patients with dry mouth feeling better?
So, this is in the published domain, so you can look me up on your Google machine, Gallupo, Wisconsin, easy enough to find. So it's safe, which is the first thing. And you know what? As the way the studies are structured is to determine safety, but it's also structured to capture data to get, at least anecdotally, is there a signal towards an effect? And I'm happy to report that the answer is yes. More than half the patients on a quality of life scale that's validated, say they feel better. And we've got some anecdotal cases like, you know, the man couldn't eat pizza because it was eating sawdust, and now he can. And they don't wake up at night to drink water. So there's, anecdotally, we're getting a signal towards effect. But to validate that rigorously, we're going to do a follow-on studies where we're going to be looking at that in larger numbers in the future.
Our guest, Dr. Jacques Gallupo, and we're talking with him about cell therapy. And you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at personalized cell therapy today with our guest, Dr. Jacques Gallupo. And great to have him with us to talk about the work at the University of Wisconsin. He is practicing hematologist, professor of oncology, and associate dean for therapeutics development, and director of the program for advanced cell therapy. is a great collaboration between UW Health and UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Join in. The question's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Tony in Mount Horeb. Tony, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I was wondering if your guest could speak about CAR-T, the acronym for the hematology procedure for, well, we're familiar with it for multiple myeloma. It might be for other blood cancers as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So great pivot because the other really promising use case of cell therapy is for cancer therapeutics. And I'll take a step back here. In your immune system, you got circulating white cells. You heard of those.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different flavors of white cells. Neutrophils fight bacteria. Monocytes fight yeast and fungus. Lymphocytes fight viruses. And the way that lymphocytes fight viral infection in your body is the virus hides in cells in your body and it pops out, and these lymphocytes recognize that and they sort of delete the infected cell. They gobble it up. They kill it. So those cells evolved the machinery to delete bad cells from your body. So that concept was repurposed. I know I told you about genetic engineering.
Yeah.
So now you can, so now you got a whole bunch of lymphocytes in your bloodstream right now as we speak, and they patrol. We can take those, you know, the way you give blood to the Red Cross, we take some blood out. We can purify the lymphocytes in there, put them in a Petri dish, and then we change their genetic makeup so that rather than them recognizing viruses, which they're designed to do, we've engineered them to recognize abnormal cancer cells because the cancer cells display on their surface proteins called antigens that make them distinct from normal cells. And that's what CAR-T technology is. It's a chimeric antigen receptor T cell. So we engineer in a protein that allows the lymphocyte to, instead of recognizing a virus-infected cell, recognizes a cancer cell, but deploys the same machinery that evolved to delete cells. So in 2014, the first human subject to receive CAR-T was a young girl out of UPenn. She was dying of leukemia. And the team at Penn was developing this platform, and she received an experimental infusion under FDA license, and it was a Lazarus effect. 3 years later, the first CAR-T was approved for a kind of leukemia called B-cell ALL. And to your caller, there are now six approved CAR-T products, of which two of them are for myeloma, which is a flavor of leukemia that affects older mm-hmm. adults. And they work great. I mean, where chemotherapy fails, because that's the limits of that, this is you're now leveraging the biology of this micro robot. I say micro robot. You infuse an army of these gene engineered cells. And these are your own cells, they're gene engineered, mm-hmm. that wipe out the cancer, and they persist and patrol and wipe out any recurrences. Now, not everybody gets a cure, but we are getting cures in patients that historically would have been it because we have at UW, we're deploying the commercial CAR-Ts, but we also have a research program where we're developing our own bespoke platform based upon our own science here that we're developing for a childhood neuroblastoma, pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, but these are still in the preclinical. But our goal is to get this in people forthwith, not a decade, few years at most.
We have many callers. Thanks, Tony, for that call. We have many callers online with questions. Teresa in Sparta has one. Let's go there. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm wondering, with all of the neurological improvements related to Parkinson's and everything, would it be possible to improve someone's IQ, someone who has a low IQ? Our son is deficient in anything related to mathematics, calendars, addition, subtraction, time. And otherwise, he can talk to you in multiple syllable words, very intelligent, and until you ask him to make change. Is there a way to attack and repair those particular cells?
So there's no data about cell therapy to improve cognition. There are many clinical trials using cell therapy to reduce brain inflammation, as that's mm-hmm. the root cause of multiple sclerosis, for example. Same thing for Alzheimer's, which is now more and more recognized as being an inflammatory disorder. So if you can hose that down, it'll help. So the impact is, for Alzheimer's, you would say that affects cognition, but it's an indirect effect by suppressing sort of the damaging inflammation, if you get what I mean. But cells to improve cognition, that is still a concept as opposed to a reality being developed.
Not yet, Teresa. Thank you very much for calling. Mary in Mineral Point. Your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with systemic lupus. I'm in treatment at UW Rheumatology. I'm taking 3 different oral medications. Is there anything on the horizon for lupus?
So, yes. In Germany, there was this young woman that, I don't want to spook you, but she had catastrophic lupus in the ICU, kidney shut down. She was dying from, and a type of cell that leads to lupus is a B cells in your body. They're kind of white cell that run amok. They mess up your immune system. They gave that young woman the same CAR T cells to remove B cell leukemia, but the intent was to remove her own normal B cells. It wiped out all the B cells that were causative of her acute lupus, and she walked out of the ICU.
Oh, my God.
So there's this whole exploding space right now of using CAR T not to remove B cell leukemia, but to delete your own endogenous B cells that are causing disease. And these are causative of disease in lupus, ulcerative colitis, and other disorders, including MS. But we're not giving them willy-nilly, because to give CAR-T, it's a bit of an expedition. It can make you quite sick at first. You may wind up being hospitalized with complications arising, which is an acceptable price to pay if you're dying from cancer. But we're always more hesitant about deploying potentially toxic interventions when you have disorders where you have lots of alternatives. But long answer to your brief question, yes, cell therapy for autoimmune disease is hot right now.
Mary, thank you very much for calling. And you said there is cell therapy for macular degeneration. I know we had some other callers asking about it.
Yeah, so I pointed out to this first-in-human clinical trial being conducted in the U.S. The corporate entity sponsoring this, I don't own any stock, so it's called OPSIS, but you can look it up, OPSIS. You can look it up on your Google machine, and they've opened up at Miami, but they do intend to open up alternative sites, and I do believe that Wisconsin is going to be one of those sites in the future.
And Sue had emailed, and I think you mentioned it in passing, that stem cell research relevant to MS.
Yeah, so it has to do with a variant which is using not so much stem cells to replace damaged neurons, but rather cell therapy using your own white cells to attenuate the autoimmune problem. And autoimmunity is your body having an allergic reaction against your brain.
Yeah.
And we can inject your own cells that are engineered or manipulated to forfeit that allergic reaction against your own brain. But that's applicable also for other severe life-threatening autoimmune disorders.
Someone else is wondering how, in terms of money, let's talk about money for a minute. You've got pills and so forth, and you've got the stem cell, you know, what you're talking about here. Is this a very expensive process, or will it be? Or I could envision the cost of it coming down over time.
So, Larry, you're right. The only way the price will come down is with competition. We know that's true for cars. It's true for washing machines. It's also true for pharmaceuticals. But in the moment, you're absolutely correct. It's frightful. The CAR T-cell therapy I spoke of, just the price of the cell drug by the commercial, because it's a drug, is $500,000. That's just the cells. The hospital treatments that are surround all that is an additional almost $500,000. So you can do the math here. You're talking a megabuck per person. There are other approved, FDA-approved cell therapies that are curative of a blood disease called sickle cell disease. Mm-hmm. Cost of treatment, $2.6 million. Now, you're going to say, is that sustainable? Well, that's a question to be posed to the commercial developers, because they're the ones who set the price. But the way they're thinking is, if I can cure a child of sickle cell disease, that young boy or young girl will not use hospital services for the rest of their life. Ergo, leading all this cost avoidance. So it's a good investment up front because of the savings down the line. That's part of the thinking there. But,
And in the meantime, you guys are doing the work that's bringing this up. And I know, I'm sure that costs and so forth will come down, as you say, with competition, just like always.
Competition and technology.
And technology.
The technology is going to be, that's the thing that can be the breakthrough, something that makes it 50%, 90% cheaper.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Jacques Alipo. It's wonderful to have you here, and great to have you listening in today. A medical show for 2 hours, and we covered a lot of information about a lot of different areas. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.